Do you know of any endeavor where the expectation of being average is acceptable? Would sending a man to the moon or writing the Constitution which created the United States be acceptable if it were just an average document? Of course not. So why is earning an average rate of return in the stock market considered to be superior behavior? For years, the mantra has been invest in low-cost index funds. And while I would agree that most investors are better off buying a low-cost S&P 500 index fund, there has to be those who treat investing as a very serious business and garner truly superior results. So today I want to discuss those other investors and their techniques to see how this other half can create so much more wealth for themselves and their investors. And allow me to introduce Frederik van Haverbeke. He's an electrical engineer who over the past decade has built considerable expertise in the areas of stock investing, company analysis, and accounting, and has published a new book. The book is entitled Excess Returns, A Comparative Study of the Methods of the World's Greatest Investors. And it truly is my pleasure to welcome Frederik, who is now joining me from Belgium. Welcome to the show, Frederik.
Yes, hello.
So let's start with the most basic question, because we hear in the United States that, you know, earning this average rate of return, this S&P 500 index return, which is one of our major indices, is really the way everybody should invest. Is it possible to beat the market over a long period of time?
Well, if you look in the introduction of my book, you will see that I discuss a number of track records of outstanding investors, which have track records that really cannot explain by chance. Because I know something about statistics, and I know that some of these track records are really so far off normal expectations that they are almost impossible. So, for instance, Warren Buffett, who probably everybody knows well, he earned 13% a year in excess of the S&P 500 in a career of 56 years. So this is proof enough, I guess, to say that there are people who can beat the market by a very substantial margin. And he's not alone. You also have Walter Schloss, for instance, who had a career of 50 years where he beat the market by 7% a year. You have Shelby Davis, which is a person who is probably less known, but who was also an outstanding investor and who had an investing career of 45 years where he beat the market by 10% a year.
So, Frederik, I think statistically speaking, if you threw enough darts at a target, some darts, and you had a line, let's say a horizontal line going through the middle, just by chance, some of those darts are going to hit above the line, some are going to hit below the line, but they're not necessarily proof that the thrower of the dart is any more accurate than chance would give him. But you're stating here that with these long track records, there is something real going on here. Am I correct in that?
That's definitely the case. I give another example of an investor in the book, which who is not really featured, but another person who beat the market, I think, in 247 out of 250 months. And if you calculate the probability that someone can beat the market that many times or better, it's close to one out of the total number of atoms on Earth. So let's say this is pretty much impossible.
All right. How generally, and I want to, you know, we'll dig into this as the interview continues, but how generally do these superior investors think about the market? What are they doing that's different, let's say, than the casual investor?
I think the main point is that they are passionate about investing. They really spend a lot of time on it. They read a lot of time. They really do a due diligence much, much deeper than the average person. They know much more about the companies they invest in. And above all, they also have an emotional setup that is very different from the average person.
What do you mean by that?
So they dare to be contrarian. So they have the courage to go against the herd. They control, they try to control their emotions. Everybody is subject to a lot of cognitive biases in behavioral finance. This is studied, this kind of phenomenon. And the thing that differentiates these top investors from the average person is that they are aware of them. and they actively try to counter them. So they try to detach themselves emotionally from their traits. They know that they have to be independent, so they try not to be influenced too much by stimuli from, let's say, financial television or whatever. They don't look at their stock prices every 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So they try to shield themselves from a lot of influences.
There are other, for money managers in particular, there are other pressures, and the one pressure is career risk.
Yes.
If you do not have a return that's close to what the average is, there's a chance that, especially if you underperform, there's a chance that people will take their money from you, which could mean less in income, and you have to, you know, you fear you have to pull your children out of private school, and your whole lifestyle, you know, would go along with it. Do these investors suffer from that as well? I mean, I would think of, for example, Peter Lynch, who ran the Fidelity Magellan Fund for all those years. He must have had some career risk worries as well, and yet it didn't seem to matter.
Well, Peter Lynch is maybe a very exceptional mutual fund manager. He probably, yeah, he's also his successor, Jeff Vinnick.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, I don't know if you know him.
Yeah.
He took over after Peter Lynch, and he was not very successful in the first 2 or 3 years after Peter Lynch, and he was fired.
Right.
But it turns out that he was an exceptionally good investor, because after that, he started his own hedge fund, and he had a truly amazing track record in the subsequent 10, 15 years. So that's an illustration of there is indeed this career risk. But Peter Lynch had very good performance from the start, from the beginning. He had some better years, some worse years, but he never said that he really felt the pressure from his management or from investors that he should do things differently. So I think Peter Lynch had an exceptional track record, and that's what actually protected him against this kind of pressure. But you are right. Many other top investors had to deal with this pressure. And someone like Warren Buffett had decided just to start investing in a kind of investment holding called Berkshire Hathaway. And that was, of course, partly given in by the fact that this would protect him against all this pressure from investors.
Well, I know Bill Ackman, who is the very well-known activist investor, is talking about starting a closed-end fund on the London Exchange, which again protects him from worrying about whether money is moving out or moving in. The book is Excess Returns, A Comparative Study of the Methods of the World's Greatest Investors. The author is with me from Belgium right now. His name is Frederik van Haverbeke, and he is talking about, you know, what characterizes, I guess, Frederik, this is the next question. Are these individual investors using one particular strategy, or are they using many different strategies, and it's just the discipline of sticking with those strategies that makes the difference?
Well, let's say that they have the same basic principles. Their methods may be somewhat different, but the basic principles are very, very, very similar for all these people. And the difference have mainly to do with these people, with their personality. So some people can't cope with shorting stocks. Mm-hmm. Other people prefer to short stocks, to be long stocks at the same time. Other people prefer or like buying turnaround stocks, whereas others prefer staying with great established companies. So that's where the main difference between these investors lies. Not really in the way they approach the market, because you have read my book, you probably have seen that there are amazing similarities in the way they think about the market, in the way they see how the market functions and how they can benefit from it.
Well, it reminds me of this idea that Warren Buffett talked about, and also Ben Graham, his mentor, about, you know, working alongside of your partner whose name is Mr. Market. You really aren't asking Mr. Market to tell you any important information, although there is some information. It's just that, you know, he comes to work with you every day and gives you a price for your business. You need to know what the value of your business is so you can buy when it's at a bargain and you can sell when it's at a premium. I mean, this idea of buying at a bargain or buying low and selling high, which sounds so easy to do and is in so many ways so difficult. Is that a strategy that it's used by most of these very successful individuals is the value strategy, looking for bargains or looking to buy a dollar for 40 cents?
All of them, all of the persons that are, all the investors that are featured in my book adhere to that strategy. I must say that there are other ways also to beat the market. And in introduction, I show some other traders, for instance, that have beaten the market by impressive margins. But my book focuses on investors, and these invest, all of them, they focus on trying to buy a stock at 40 or 50 or 60 cents on the dollar and trying to sell it when it is close to $1 or higher. So that's what my book is focused on.
Well, you know, Warren Buffett used to do that, but he changed his methodology some years ago, trying to buy very, very good businesses at reasonable prices, which again is in a way what Peter Lynch was doing. He was buying growth companies at a reasonable price. And yet, you know, of all of the investors that you mentioned, you know, Warren Buffett has accumulated the most amount of money. As a matter of fact, there's a quote in the book, which I very much like. It's from the 1996 shareholder letter of Warren Buffett for Berkshire Hathaway. And he quotes, or I quote, "I would rather be certain of a good result than hopeful of a great one. I don't look to jump over 7-foot bars. I look around for 1-foot bars that I can step over." What's your opinion on that?
Well, to come back to what you said, that he changed his strategy, you're right, but that doesn't contradict the fact that he's still trying to buy great companies at cheap prices, mm-hmm. So at 60 cents to the dollar. But with respect to the quote, what he refers to is that he doesn't like complex stocks, mm-hmm. Doesn't like complex businesses. He doesn't like, for instance, also businesses where it's hard to predict how they will perform over the next few years, like technology companies. They are not his favorites. He doesn't like them too much because he says that the technology landscape and competitive situation changes so rapidly in technology that it is very hard to look a few years forward. And so he looks for companies when he opens an annual report and when he sees that the financial statements are very hard to read, he just skips them.
He just skips them. You know, one of the great investors you mentioned in your book was John Templeton. John Templeton is considered the father of mutual funds by many, many people. And one area where he excelled was not in the purchase necessarily of individual companies, but in investing overseas in individual countries. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, he's very famous, for instance, for investing in Japan before a lot of other investors discovered Japan. So in the 1960s, 1970s, John Templeton was quite active in Japan because he discovered the fact that the accounting practices in Japan were very different from the United States, such that many investors who looked at Japan and who didn't dig into it had the impression that it was not so cheap. But if you dug in deeper, then he saw that there were truly amazing bargains on the Japanese market. And he made a lot of money on Japanese stocks way before other people in the 1980s started to discover Japan. Yeah. He also invested in Mexico and other countries. And just to give you an example, I think the name of the company he invested in Mexico was Telefonos de Mexico. He was a very thorough investor. He didn't trust the numbers also because that was one of the reasons why he was in foreign countries, because he knew that many foreign countries were misunderstood because of differences in accountancy. And Telefonos de Mexico published some numbers that he didn't trust. And then he started to count the number of telephone lines in Mexico. And from that, he discovered that the income of Telefonos de Mexico was really understated massively, and that it was a truly amazing bargain.
So the key here is that he didn't take things at face value. He used his knowledge, yeah. He used his common sense. He went the extra mile. There are a lot of stocks that people won't touch because they're under $10 a share, or there's institutional managers that just won't look at a company because by definition of what they're allowed to invest in, they can't buy anything that's under $5 a share. Or if a company is not followed by a bunch of analysts, so that creates another opportunity for a great investor to go in and do their own work and do their own research. Frederick, there was one characteristic of the book that I was, you know, interested in as well, is that even Warren Buffett admits that it's very, very hard to value a company. There's numerous ways to do that. How do these investors deal with that challenge of figuring out what a company is actually worth? We've only got about 2 minutes.
The main point they like to stress is that people have to focus on their circle of competence. They have to invest in what they know best. They have to focus on companies or in industries that they are familiar with. And when you have this familiarity, it's easier to understand the financial statements and to value a company. That's probably the most important lesson I can extract from their advice.
So I guess there's just no substitute for hard work here. And many people think that investing is easy because access to investments are so easy, but the actual putting together the information, acting on it correctly, is really not a very easy thing to do. Final words?
Yes, I totally agree. All of them are really obsessed with investing and with reading. They read. Warren Buffett reads 7 newspapers a day. Mm-hmm. He reads a lot of annual reports a day. So all of them are really very, very hard workers.
I think it's interesting, too, that Berkshire Hathaway has about $50 billion in cash. Now, I was at the Berkshire Hathaway meeting some months ago, and he basically said that he likes to keep about $20 billion in cash. So there's $30 billion sitting there that he's kind of waiting for what he calls a fat pitch or some great company that he can buy at a reasonable price. It is possible, not a prediction, but that things are a little expensive because he's letting this cash accumulate, isn't he?
I fear that that is true.
Yeah.
You look at the valuation of the stock market, especially in the United States, it looks pretty expensive.
My guest, Frederik van Haverbeke. His book is Excess Returns, a comparative study of the methods of the world's greatest investors. And he has joined me from Belgium for this interview. Frederik, thank you so much for joining me.